All right, qualify briefly. At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify. Okay, I do have a year's continuous sobriety. My home group is Central, and I have attended a group conscious meeting. I don't know what to say about Alcoholics Anonymous that hasn't already been said in this room, in any of these rooms around the world. Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. It's changed me for the better, I hope. You know, I just don't have the problems that I used to have when I drank. I don't know why. I don't know what happened. It's like, you know, that kind of stuff just quit happening to me. I drank like a pig when I did. The last few years of my using and abusing were textbook alcoholism. I mean, it's in the big book right there. I did just about what it says. So, you know, tried drinking other things. I tried quitting. I tried, you name it. I tried it all. It didn't work until I walked through the doors with a whole lot of willingness. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. Thank you. Okay. Now I get to introduce the speaker. Well, I tell you what, the first time I met George was here at a noon meeting a couple of years ago, and I really liked the guy right off the bat. Every time he shares in a noon meeting, it's like everybody is just, boom, focused on George. And it's like everybody listens to what George is going to say or what he has to share, because it's always right on the money. I got lucky enough a few months ago to ask him to be my sponsor because I was going completely out of my mind in sobriety, which we know happens, and I needed some help. So I asked a man who I know has done the deal, has done the 12 steps with a sponsor. So I asked the man, and let me tell you what, my life, like I said, is pretty damn good right now. I'm not, I have no complaints whatsoever. Well, anyway, here's George. That's enough out of me.
My name is George. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, George.
And if you'll indulge me, I'll take a second moment of silence to collect my thoughts and invite my higher power in to hopefully work through me and bring a message to you. Thank you. They said, my name is George, I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is 1/13/98. It's not the first sobriety date that I have, but it's the one that I'm currently using, and I like it. You know, one of the things that happens to me when I'm asked to speak is I kind of go haywire for about a week prior to speaking, and it comes out in all sorts of terrible ways. It really does. I tend to look back and reflect upon my life, and there's a lot of dark and ugly things that I didn't like about my youth and about the things that I've done in this life. It kind of gets broadcast, and for that I need to apologize to my girlfriend and my family at large, because they become the brunt of that, and they receive it. And I mean that sincerely. It's not pretty, you know, and unbeknownst to them. You know, my ego would like me to think that you're all here to see me, but in fact I know that there are a lot of people collecting medallions and have brought family members, you know, so welcome and congratulations to all of you who are picking up medallions tonight. Yeah, absolutely. I'd like to speak to the guy or the girl who's a lot like me, though, that they found out that there's free coffee and cake tonight, and that's the reason why they showed up. Because I did that a lot at AA. I did that back in Boston. They had these huge social events that revolved around anniversaries. You'd hear it at every meeting. Somebody's having an anniversary and a dance. And that's pretty much what I did the first time I came to AA, is that I drank coffee, I ate donuts, and I chased women. And I love that program, you know. The problem is that program does not work in the long term. You know, what happened to me was that because I had no spiritual defense, no defense, actually, against alcohol, I drank again. You know, when life got rough, I drank again. You know, whenever I had a situation or circumstance to which I didn't, you know, I didn't have a solution, the solution was always alcohol. And I never understood that. I never even gave it thought. You know, during the course of this week, I've been thinking about, you know, my past in my youth, and because it's fading. But the thing is that I was looking at the things that I loved in this life, the things that I really enjoyed before I drank or before alcohol really became a problem. And one of the things that was important to me was music. You know, I absolutely loved music as a kid. Later on in life, I became a DJ in the nightclubs, and my world centered around that. And the thing with that was that I could spin music all day long in my cellar and not, you know, not care. You know, I just love to bend sound, as I called it. You know, I like to mix and match sound. And I think about that because that's something that alcohol and drugs took from me. You know, what it became was like, for lack of a better term, I was prostituting my joy in order to fulfill what I wanted, which was I was working in the nightclubs, and that's the scene where alcohol and drugs were. And it polluted and changed it. And I think about that, and that's really sad to me, because it was kind of like this dual life that existed. You know, you can't be a gangster and run around in a tutu at the same time. You know? It doesn't mix, you know. And your friends look at you funny, and they were looking at me funny anyway. But the thing with it was, it created these secrets, you know, secret after secret, and you can't tell anybody. You know, I mean, you might want to, and every now and again you get drunk enough or high enough, and it would slip out. You know, something might slip out, but you were real tight to the vest about some stuff, like it's going to the grave. You know, and that's what it was like for me, and that's really what I look at the problem is. I was chock full of these secrets. I couldn't tell anybody. You know, I wanted to. You know, I would have loved to, but I couldn't. You know, I was married, and for 3 years nobody knew I was married because of the lifestyle I was living. You know, if people know what your weak point is, they'll use it. And my thought process was that I didn't want them to know about my family life or, you know, my family or anything like that. You know, I didn't want them to be able to touch it. You know, so this duality started. You know, this separation. You know, church and state, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, there was a lot of things. You know, in my family, you know, my family loves me. You know, and I was as good as I could be to my family. You know, and try to live this life that I'm living. The problem was it always slipped out. You know, it always slipped out. I remember that my sister banished me from her home and her children. And the reason why she did that was because my brother had told her that I was selling cocaine. And he told her some amount that wasn't true. It was close, but it wasn't true. You know. You know. And her husband, who, you know, didn't like me, decided that it was either, you know, banish him from the home and keep him from coming down here and protect the children, or, you know, I'm divorcing you. And he gave her that ultimatum, and she called me and told me. And I wasn't so mad about that. I was mad that she had judged me. You know, she had judged me prior to the trial, and I didn't have an opportunity to stand in front of her and state my case. You know, and I had told her at that time, you know, sweetie, blood is thicker than water, you know, and you'll be coming back to let me know, and blah, blah, blah. But she was right to do that, you know. I would never have done anything to her children. I would never do anything intentionally, you know, to harm her kids or her family or the family life, my family in general. You know, that meant everything to me. They were the only people that I truly loved or cared about. And yet, you know, there it was. That's the first indicators of where everything is changing for me. So now inside I feel I've got no family, or you know, I'm taking what my sister says to heart, and I'm going to separate myself. I'm going to separate myself, and I'm going to pull away, not because I hate them, but because I love them. You know, I don't want to hurt them. So that's what I do, and I start to separate. further and further away, you know, and that's the only thing of any value to me. So now I'm left with nothing. Yeah. But I can drink and drug. Yeah. In 1998, I put myself in the position where the state and Commonwealth of Massachusetts was funding my drinking, and I had all day long to do so. And I could live the lifestyle that I had. I had dry goods for sale. I heard somebody say that the other day. And I was like, right on. I had some dry goods for sale, you know, and that would keep me in, you know, socks and shoes, and wasn't much call for food, you know. So I got to drink, you know, I had the dream. I lived the dream. I drank every day the way I wanted to, and there was nobody to stop me. Nobody. You know, there was plenty of resource, you know, and yet the failing point came, because the truth about it is that in that, I'm living in my house with a cat and a red velour couch in the middle of summer, and the voices in my head are saying this, you know, I think the cat is ratting me out to the DEA. I've got the cans all lined up, and she's moving them, you know. I got strings on the door up high. She can't get up that high, but somebody's coming in the house late night. You know that, right? I got the curtains drawn, you know, and I'm as lonely as you can be. You know, I have a computer, a laptop. Well, the first one was about this big. It was one of them eight, those old 70s boom boxes, you know, the old laptop. And I'm out online trying to talk to these women, because that's the only way I'm possibly going to get a date. You know? And the fact is that God is already now interceding in my life, and I don't know. He's on the job. I'm out in these chat rooms, man, and I'm being clever, and I'm thinking, they love me. They love me. And they're saying things like, seek help. You know? They were all, the sad part was, and nothing against this, they were all Christian women, which was amazing to me. You know, I mean, really, the love that they were trying to show me, and just, you know, they understood how exactly lonely I must be, you know, and they were charitable, you know, and they would have conversations with me, you know, and that was the only lifeline to reality that there was. You know. Because I had locked myself in this house, and I was getting people to deliver everything to me. You know, I had booze coming, I had everything I needed coming, and and I was doing just fine. You know, doing just fine. So there it is. It's August of '98, and I'm thinking to myself, you know, I can't do this anymore. Right? I'm going to move to Florida. Because my mom had moved down here about 14 years ahead of me. So I'm going to move down there. So I start selling off all my worldly possessions, you know, which was not much of anything. But all of my DJ equipment and my sound systems and stuff, I decided that I would give them to my nephew. You know, this is my charitable heart. So I had formulated this plan, and the plan started with a quart of Captain Morgan, which I was drinking at the time. That stuff kind of made me crazy. The plan was simple. I was going to drive 70 miles to his house, pick him up, bring him back to my house to load the stuff into my car to drive back down to his house. And that's the kind of thinking that I have when I'm drinking. This is a good plan, by the way, to a guy like me. So I enforce the plan. And I get down to his house, and I'm about half a quart in. And I get him and his buddy in the car. And we drive back, and we have to make a stop because I'm empty. And we have to make a stop because I need some supplements. You know, and I put him in harm's way for the first time in that I took him to a neighborhood that he had never been to and should never have to be in. And I left him sitting in the car and said, I'll be back in about 10 minutes. came back out, got him, went over to my house, and proceeded to load all the stuff. Drank. And then we were about 30 feet from his driveway. It was an intersection. I came to a stop. There's a street in front of me, and his driveway is right there. And I proceeded to go through the stop sign, and we get into this accident, T-boned on his side of the car. And by the grace of God, nothing happened to him, you know, or his friend. But there's where my sister was right. There's where she was right. Yeah. I had no intention of harming him, but I put him in harm's way. Yeah. When my intention, and I think about things like that, you know. That was my first DUI. You know, prior to that, I had been arrested and in jail and all sorts of stuff. But, you know, I had powerful friends when I grew up. I did a lot of political work for these powerful friends, and they paid me back by keeping me out of jail. I would make phone calls. But for some reason, when this police officer arrested me, I didn't call any of them. I didn't, you know, I just didn't. I didn't want to. I was done. You know, I was just so sick of myself. I was just so sick at that moment. They took me to jail, and they put me in the psych cell, go figure. And it was in one of them plexiglass cells, and I would sit in the cell and I would run across and bang my head on it, you know, and then sit back down and chant, you know. True, you know, and because I liked the vibration inside my head, you know. I really liked, you know, just, I wanted the pain is really the truth of it. I wanted the physical pain to match the emotional pain that was happening. Yeah. So I got out of jail. And I got a DUI, and you think that that would have been enough, but that's not enough to stop, you know. But in that jail cell, I said that prayer that we all say, you know, and it was the first time ever in my life I meant it or said it in the fashion in which I said it. I'd never reached that level of sincerity again. I said, please, God, help me. I can't live like this. I can't live like this, and I would have preferred to die. You know, matter of fact, when I get out, the thoughts of suicide started then. You know, so I carried through on my plan, and I came down to Florida. You know, and I continued to drink. The only difference was that now the state of Massachusetts had taken all of my money, and I was left with a bicycle and a backpack. You know, and I moved down here. I had a fantastic bicycle. You know, they had a fishing rod holder on it. I had made that. I had my tackle box, and everything I needed was in that backpack. You know, and I would go fishing every day. I don't know what I fished for because I was never near the water. You know? I would go to this place called Roscoe's. That's the name. Roscoe's. It was the one on this side of the bridge, not the one on that side of the bridge. Yeah. And Roscoe's was a country place. A lot of country people, a lot of cowboys with cowboy hats. I'm not really a cowboy guy. I don't have a cowboy accent. They notice that. They notice that I don't have a southern accent. They also notice that I was an obnoxiously loud northerner, prone to saying whatever was on his mind. Therefore, a lot of fights. So I get into this fight one night, somewhere in January, and the guys beat the tar out of me, I would suspect. I called my brother to come and pick me up, and he did that, and he took me back to his house, and my other brother was staying there as well, and I continued to drink and do what I do, and then I supposedly passed out, at least according to me. And I guess during the middle of the night, I woke up and I walked into his bedroom and I peed all over him. And it is, I mean, to most people that's funny. To a guy like me, it's heartbreaking. Because that's the last piece of moral fiber I had. See, I'm telling you, I only care about my family. I could care about nobody else. I stepped over a lot of bodies to get here, to do the things that I wanted to do. You know, but my family is everything. And it broke my heart. When I walked into my brother and I said to him, you know, we got to get these, that guy that beat me up last night, he said, I did that. It crushed me. I had no place to go at that point. Nowhere to hide. You know, and here comes the suicide. The thought, I'm no good, I'm no value. So, I sent it over to my mom's. She's a good Catholic woman, this woman. She's clever. You know, she's going to have an intervention with all of her friends and the priest. Not the priest. And she had said to me, why don't you go back to AA? And I had forgotten that AA even existed. But it was the first time the truth came out of me, and I said to her, Mom, why would I want to go to AA? I just want to blow my freaking brains out. You know, it's not the kind of thing my mom wanted to hear. Yeah. But as I said, she's a good woman. And she conned me into going to two meetings because I had said to her, I have to go back up to Boston to face all these criminal charges. I'll go to one meeting before I go up there. And if I come back and I'm not doing the 20 years, then I'll do another meeting. So I did that. An amazing thing happened. I went to this one meeting and I met this gentleman. He became my sponsor. I flew up to Boston, and when I got to the airport, I didn't drink. When I was on the plane, I didn't drink. When I got off the plane, I didn't drink. There's about 100 bars in Boston that owe me money. I can drink for free for the rest of my life. And I didn't drink. I went to court, and outside the courthouses in Boston, there's always a bar. You know, and I'm thinking I'm going to go to jail for a long, long time, and I didn't drink. I pled guilty. And I never do that. Really? Mickey Mouse thing, guilty, guilty. So, they gave me probation. A year, and they let me transfer it to Florida. Massachusetts doesn't do that. They want their money, and they want you to stay there while you pay. But they let me. I came back down here, and I didn't drink. And I went to my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't had a drink since. It's amazing. It's the grace of God. Now, I can tell you all the things that I've done to stay sober. You know, I can give you this litany of how George rode his bicycle 20 miles every day in the heat of August and you know, all of this stuff that I did to stay sober. But it's the grace of God that I am sober. That's the difference. You know, what happened was I figured out the value of Alcoholics Anonymous. I figured out the value of staying here. And not drinking. You know, the book talks about all of these promises. They don't sound attractive to somebody who's looking for euphoria. You know, he's, you know, wow, who really gives a crap about fearing nothing? I'd like to, I'd like to go see Mars if you don't mind. You know, that's the way I think. But I found the value, you know, the real life, practical applications. Clarence taught me those. You people teach me those. I'm not, you know, I'm not a guy with a degree. I don't have an AA in AA. You know. I'm not a spiritual guru or religious person by any means. You know, I don't have anything but my experience you know, since I've been here, you know, and prior to here. And I'd like to give you that. I mean, I'd love to open up a new person's head and go, here you go, you know, and watch you scream and laugh and then stay sober. That'd be great, you know. But the fact is I can't do that. I don't transmit God like that. You know, all I can tell you is what has happened to me. You know, they talked about the testimonials back in the day of AA. You know, and the testimonial is simple. You know, for me, it was a simple prayer. So prayer becomes the answer. Prayer is the solution for me. Simple prayer is not, I want a house and a yacht and blah, blah, blah. The simple prayer is the strength. You know, the honesty of the prayer. You know, as I said, I can't reach that same level of sincerity that I had when I first got sober. I'd love to be able to feel that level. I'd love to be able to feel the joy at that level as well. It's different for me today. I can remember, you know, I didn't have a license for a year and a half in sobriety, riding the bike around, and I finally got a license, and I got a car, and I'm driving down the highway, and there's nothing special about the day or anything else, and I mean, the tears are just rolling down my face of the joy, you know, of feeling like I'm back in life. I'm back into the mainstream of life. I'm not sitting out in the outskirts. You know, I've always been out there somewhere. You know, come on back, Josh. You know, the fact is that, you know, none of that is me. You know, I can tell you that it's like amazing to me. It's like, yeah, I work the steps. I don't know what that means in terms of like pitch and shovel and, you know, all of that. I don't know what that means. I work them steps diligently every day for 30 days. It's not what it was like. What it was like is I put them inside of me, and I tried to live them, live by them, you know. And by that I mean the honesty, the open-mindedness, and the willingness. I mean, those are the words in the book. What it is in my head is cut the crap, George. Stop lying. Long before I drank, I was a liar, a cheat, and a thief. Alcohol didn't make me that. That's what I was, you know. I couldn't change that. No human power, no penal system was going to change any of that. The only thing that could change that was my higher power. He changed my mind. It is irrevocably changed. I have no desire to drink today. I haven't had a desire to drink in 14 years. I've had fantasies, I've had thoughts, I've had stupid ideas, you know, of which I have not carried out, of which I have applied what you people suggest. What I have today is living skills that you gave me that I didn't have. You know, when I was married, I loved this woman. You know, it was the reason why I came to AA the first time. I absolutely adored this woman. I would do anything for her. I could not stay stopped. I could not stay sober. You know? And it's amazing to me because I look at that and love was there. I mean, it was there. That should be enough of a driving force to change. It was not enough to overcome alcoholism. So when I look back at that, I look back at my relationship over the course of the last week with my ex, and I had no skills. I was selfish. I was self-centered. I was dishonest at all times. It was always about me, what I want, and what I want to drink. Anything that we did revolved around that. I remember once we went to the movies, and I brought a bottle of Jack Daniels in. And she said, do you have to do that? And I said, no, we don't have to watch this movie at all. That's the deal. That's what you're dealing with. You know? So there's no reason why that marriage should have continued. I wanted it to for selfish reasons. You know, for selfish reasons. Today, my relationships aren't like that. I don't have friendships. I don't have family relations. I don't even have sponsee relationships that are all about me. They're not that way. They're about an us or a greater good, more so than they are about the individuals within it. There's a certain amount of reward that I get, in having these friendships and these relationships. I actually feel like a human being. I feel like, something worthwhile. I had no purpose prior to coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I have a purpose. It's to carry a message to a sick and suffering alcoholic. It's actually just to have a conversation with somebody and tell them that they don't have to live this way anymore. I don't have to do that within the confines of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't have to have a great meeting to do that. I can do that out on the street. I'm not out there, trust me, I'm not out there crusading. I'm not out there preaching to anybody about Alcoholics Anonymous. I just know that God presents these opportunities for me to do the job that I'm rightly placed to do. I can talk to another alcoholic when he's standing in front of me, or sitting in front of me, or at the airport, or wherever it is. It's strange how it happens. It's beyond me. There's another practical application that I found to be very true in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is for me to share my shortcomings with you. For me to stand here in front of you and tell you the truth about me, which is I ain't all that. And I ain't all that most of the time. The fact of the matter is, that there's nothing special about this. Standing up here and speaking to you in truth. What's special is what God has done for me. God has made it so that I can do that. He's made it so that I can speak to you and say, in truth, I'm a liar, a cheat, and a thief. That I'm a drug addict. That I'm an alcoholic. That I'm whatever I am or whatever I was, And I couldn't do that before. I couldn't tell you my secret. I told Clarence everything about me. Everything about me. And I waited for him, to recoil hideously. That never happened. What I got was a man who understood me and liked me, knowing all about me. That's a strange thing. Today I have plenty of guys that I know and like for the same reasons. Clarence said one thing to me that changed me dramatically. We were doing my fourth step and into a fifth step, and I was telling him some deviant about me, and he said, "Part of you like that." I want to hear that one. Especially within the confines of the circumstance, I did not want to hear that. But there's truth to it, because part of me must have liked it in order for me to hang on to it that long. Part of me loved alcohol. I could only love alcohol and do it for that long. There's no way I could possibly have done it if I didn't love it or I didn't like it. And when I look at the rest of my sordid history, there's truth in that too. So if you're new and you're here for the coffee and the cake, good. Stay here. You don't have to go anywhere. This is the safest place in town. When I first came here, there's all these voices in my head telling me all these things. But every time I sat in the chair at Alcoholics Anonymous, I always felt safe. Like nobody was going to get me. Nobody's going to hurt me. Nobody's going to try and do something to me. And no one ever has. Nothing bad has ever happened to me from coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. That's life stuff. There's a difference, by the way. In the book, it says that we are we're capable of staying away from a drink based on a spiritual condition. it does not mean that we are absolved from life and life circumstances. So once again, I get back to the fact that you people taught me how to cope with life. You know, about 5 years ago, maybe a little bit longer, a good friend of ours' husband died in her arms. Some of you know her. And she would come into the meeting and she would say this, and she would say it over and over. And I used to say, you keep talking, you keep saying it, you keep saying it, you know. And I wish I had words to console her or say something, you know, brilliant, because I'm always big about being brilliant. You know, the fact is I didn't, but I knew that what she was doing was right, you know, and it was good for her. And she got through that without drinking. 2 years ago, my dad died in my arms. I put the last breath into his body as I said goodbye. 10 minutes prior than that, I was joking with him, you know, and he couldn't breathe, but he still laughed. And you think, what do you do there? Well, I do what she did. I did exactly what she did. I came to a meeting. I called my friends. I told them the truth about it. I felt the pain. And I didn't drink. Anything is possible here. Everything is possible here. If you drink, nothing is possible. What I've learned in my experience is that when I drink, the curtain falls. I immediately become separated from any possibility of God helping me. I can't see him. I can't hear him. I'm just in the blackness. That's just my experience. I don't speak for anybody else, you know. But the fact is that that is what I didn't know. That there was a curtain down. That there was a separation. I never knew about it until I got here. The last thing I want to do is read something for you. A friend of mine, you know, about 2 years ago, we were at dinner, and he says, you know, if you had an anthem, because I'm musical, you know, if you had an anthem, what song would you want to introduce you when you enter the room? That's the kind of question that boggles my mind. I mean, I've got thousands upon thousands of records that go, and every time it came up, Out of Control by U2, you know? That was just, every time it came up that, you know? And over the course of the last 2 years, you know, I've had occasion where I've asked myself that question, what song are you playing, George? What song are you playing? You know, and it changes. You know, sometimes it's a happy song, sometimes it's not so nice. You know, it's an angry metal, you know. But the fact is that it changed. And the one that has struck me, you know, for this week and for this, you know, moment, is this one. It's a song from 1989. It's by a group called Inner City. It was a house song. I was a big house DJ. Stomping. Stomping, yeah. But the thing with it is that I talk about open-mindedness. So I say open your mind a little bit when you hear a song. You know, it's not, you know, necessarily the people singing the song. If God speaks through people, then there's a possibility he speaks through music. That's what I said. You don't have to believe that. But if he could, he would have a juxtaposition. He could take the lead or the background or whatever. So picture of God, we're singing this song to you in your new. Let me take you to a place I know you want to go. It's a good life. Good life. I want to stand around and beg you, just don't say no. I've got a feeling that you're going to like what I'm doing to you. And I know what I'm doing. I'll be doing what you want me to do. Love is shining. Life is thriving in the good life. There's a feeling that you get from the good life. Once you get that good life feeling, let me tell you, no one can take it away. And I cross-reference that to this. Yes, there is a substitute. It is vastly more than that. It is a fellowship in Alcoholics Anonymous. There you will find release from care, boredom, and worry. Your imagination will be fired. Life will mean something at last. The most satisfactory of years lie ahead. Thus we find the fellowship, and so will you. I wish you all a good life.